Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Plotte in Washington, D.C.
And we've had many victories because of this alliance with the ANC, the ruling party in South Africa. Since 1994, we've moved from the days when workers were treated a little better than slaves to today when we have some of the most progressive labor laws in the world.
The Congress of South Africa Trade Unions, or COSATU, plans to endorse the ANC in the coming elections.
So every year we have a somewhat different mix of people who come, though consistently we're getting kind of the highest levels of representation from the African side. We'll have African heads of state, we'll have ministers from across the continent who are responsible for trade or health or ICT.
Seven African leaders confirm participation in the coming 16th U.S.-Africa Business Summit in Dallas, Texas.
We are under an illusion of the assumption that that is minimum wage negotiation. It's not correct. Minimum wage negotiation has to pass through a tripartite procedure, bringing employers, employees, and members of the private sector.
And Nigeria's Trade Union Congress, or TUC, says the pay increase for public sector workers undermines ongoing minimum wage negotiations between the government and labor unions. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Congress of South Africa Trade Unions, or COSATU, says it will endorse the governing African National Congress, or ANC, in the coming elections. It also says its alliance with the ANC remains strong. It comes after critics say the decline of the ANC's electoral prospects is due to the ruling party's relationship with COSATU. It also follows criticism from the Democratic Alliance, the main opposition party, which accuses both the ANC and COSATU as enemies of the jobless. Thus, as the opposition and political analysts say, they expect the ANC to lose support in the coming May 29 national elections. Matthew Parks is COSATU's parliamentary representative. He tells me that although the trade union has differences with the ANC, the alliance remains strong.
COSATU has an historical alliance with the ANC. In fact, since our founding in 1985, during the liberation struggle for democracy, we've maintained that alliance post-democracy because we recognize that the workers' struggles are not just about voting and about a democratic establishment, but also about improving workers' conditions at the workplace, to improve the lives of working class communities. And we've had many victories because of this alliance with the ANC, the ruling party in South Africa. Since 1994, we've moved from the days when workers were treated a little better than slaves to today when we have some of the most progressive labor laws in the world that affirm the right of workers to a safe workplace, the right to unionize, to collective bargaining, the right of workers to maternity leave, which is paid, or parental leave, which is paid. And whilst we appreciate all of these achievements, we do have major challenges, including a 41% unemployment rate, deep levels of poverty and inequality inherited from the apartheid era. And we need to tackle those. And I think for us, why we support the ANC is because it's been with us in these journeys. It's the only political party which has shown itself to be a partner to trade unions and to embrace workers' demands. And of course, we've got so many issues we still must tackle. We think the ANC is most reliable ally as we journey and tackle those challenges.
Criticisms being leveled by some workers in South Africa say that by endorsing ANC, that has lost popularity because of poor service delivery, you are endorsing incompetence ahead of the elections. What's your response to that?
No, we've always unashamedly called out the ANC in government when it makes mistakes, publicly, privately. We've even had marches to government when the previous president, Jacob Zuma, let the nation down through his inability to manage his personal financial appetites. So our relationship with the ANC is not about friendship. It's not a blank check. It's not a free ride politically. It's conditional upon the ANC continuously putting in place legislation, budgets, and policies and interventions to improve workers' working conditions, to improve the lives of working class communities and the families of workers. And we've seen many, many achievements in that regard. A few years ago, we had the minimum wage introduced. A couple of years ago, government rolled out a funding scheme to help millions of workers, millions of students rather, access university education when they couldn't afford it. So for us, those are important things. But also we appreciate when governors, when the ANC have blundered badly, like on the issue of corruption, they have taken action. The vice president was removed. Corrupt ministers from cabinet were removed. Corrupt senior officials in the state have been removed. Many of them have now been found guilty and are being prosecuted. Assets which are stolen have been attached and being returned. The state law enforcement agencies are being rebuilt and being expanded to deal with this crime and corruption. The revenue service, the tax agency is being strengthened to tackle tax evasion. So I think for us, those are positive things. And even areas which are very, very difficult, like unemployment, we've seen unemployment falling by 10% in the last year. So I think the times are difficult, but we appreciate when we make progress, and we need to do much more. But we know when it comes to a political party, the only party which has ever shown an interest in workers' issues is the ANC. Other political parties promise either to scrap all the labor laws, to remove all of workers' rights and protections and benefits, or they promise to take us to a populist adventurism which would collapse the economy and deter any investment from coming to South Africa.
But Matthew, the Democratic Alliance, the second biggest opposition party in South Africa, calls both the COSATU and ANC enemy of the jobless. That means you are not representing the interest of those people who do not have jobs in South Africa. And due to the high unemployment rate, both the Alliance, the ANC and COSATU has failed the people of South Africa who do not have jobs. Your reaction to that?
So the DA is a party led by rich white men who are about 4% of society. It has no black leaders. In fact, every black leader who joins it ends up packing his bags after a couple of years and leaving, citing racism. But let's leave that aside. DA says trade unions are basically workers. Trade unions are organizations of nurses, of teachers, of cleaners, of police officers who simply want to improve their working conditions, who want to have an increase in their salary every year to be protected from inflation. So we're not sure how is an enemy of the unemployed. Not sure how, because someone has been able to find a job as a waitress, makes them an enemy of the unemployed. Workers want to see unemployment being reduced for several reasons. One is because on average, each South African worker supports about 7 unemployed relatives. So that's a pressure point on workers' salaries. It overstretches the salary. So workers have a direct financial interest in seeing others getting employed, so there's less pressure on them to support relatives. We're also desperate to see unemployment being reduced, because often workers accept to see their labor rights being violated. Often they accept below subpar conditions because they're so desperate for work.
Matthew Parks is COSATU's parliamentary representative. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. In Zambia, the leader of the opposition Citizens First Party is calling on the government to protect workers from abuse by employers. Harry Kalaba says the administration should crack down on employers who refuse to respect or comply with the country's employment laws and labor practices. His comments come as Zambians express concern about employers who they accuse of focusing on profits rather than their well-being. Supporters of the government say the administration continues to work with employers and labor unions to ensure a win-win situation for all. Harry Kalaba tells me that the government must do more to ensure the welfare of Zambian workers.
There's a big problem that is brewing in Zambia, and that problem is basically that government is more interested with the employers than the employees. We have paid stores. These are stores that have come from outside Zambia. Their conditions of service are very minimal, and yet government has paid a blind eye to them. We have the mines in this country, but government is more interested in giving tax holidays to the owners of the mines as opposed to the ones working in the mines. This is a big problem for our country.
But Harry, these companies you have mentioned have been in Zambia for a long time. So why is the government being blamed here? It's not a fair criticism, supporters of the government say.
I think what is important to remember is that this particular government, which is currently in power, came on the platform that they were going to ensure that some of the excesses that were not looked at by the previous regime will be addressed when they come into government. They have come into government, and so we are holding them accountable to what they had promised the people in the mines. They promised the workers in the mines that they were going to see better days than they were seeing before they came into government. They had promised workers working in these chain Shoprite stores that they were going to have better wages and better services, which they're not seeing today. And so we are just calling them to account for the promises that they had given the Zambian people, promises they have failed to fulfill.
How will this help the ordinary Zambian worker? Because your critics are saying this is yet another opportunity for you to provide solutions to the challenges you see instead of bashing the government.
Look, I think for government to be missing an opportunity if they'll be looking at this as the mere criticism from the opposition. This is not a mere criticism. This is what is obtaining on the ground. Our ordinary workers are struggling in front of their employers, and government has chosen to elect silence. We have situations where our employees have been abused by their employers, but government has elected silence, clearly telling you that this government is on the side of the employers as opposed to the employees, because the majority of the people, especially those in the mines, have continued to suffer abuse, they have continued to suffer low wages, they continue to suffer, and yet the government has elected silence.
Supporters of the government that I have spoken with said this new government has made efforts to try to ensure a win-win situation between workers' protection and, you know, the employers, who will create more jobs for Zambians to work in, thereby reducing the unemployment rate in Zambia, and that this should be the way forward instead of criticism being leveled by the opposition just to score cheap political points ahead of the next elections.
And exactly this is what is going to bring down this government in 2026, because they don't want anybody to say anything about them. And truth be told, we are speaking about facts. Let me draw an example here, which is very clear. Before they came in government, they said that they will insist on making sure that the wages of Zambians working in the mines was going to be like that of countries like Chile and Argentina, which countries are also copper producing. This has not happened. What has happened is that the miners in Zambia continue wallowing in abject poverty. Government has gone ahead to give tax holidays to the owners of the mines, and yet they have not given any tax incentives to the workers working in the mines. This is where the problem is.
In politics, the popular saying is that you campaign in poetry and you govern in prose. There are unforeseen circumstances. What is the way forward from your perspective?
The way forward from our perspective is that government must be more people sensitive. Government must begin feeling the challenges that the people are going through. Time is up. Zambian people are going to hold them accountable for everything that they did and said. And because of that, they cannot say that we are just criticizing them for the sake of criticizing them. We are speaking because most of our people are wallowing in poverty. We are speaking because our people have been neglected. We are speaking because this government, they give tax holidays, they give tax incentives to outsiders and not Zambians. And when we speak, they accuse us of baseless criticism.
Harry Kalaba is the leader of the opposition Citizens First Party. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. Seven African leaders have confirmed participation in the 16th U.S.-Africa Business Summit in Dallas, Texas. The conference, which is organized by the Corporate Council on Africa, is from Monday, May 6 to 9. Florizel Lizier, president and CEO of the Corporate Council on Africa, tells VOA the summit provides a major platform for deepening U.S.-Africa business ties across key sectors, including agribusiness, energy, health, infrastructure, trade facilitation, ICT, and finance. She tells me that the summit also brings together over 1,500 U.S. and African public and private sector executives. She adds that the three-day conference provides networking opportunities, facilitating meetings between U.S. and African private sector executives, government representatives, investors, and entrepreneurs. Here's part one of the conversation.
So first of all, just have to say that, you know, we think that the U.S.-Africa Business Summit, which CCA puts on every year, each one is unique in a different way. It is, I think, amongst all the business associations, you know, we're the only one that's solely focused on Africa. And each summit brings together leaders from both the government and the private sector in both US and Africa. So every year we have a somewhat different mix of people who come, though consistently we're getting kind of the highest levels of representation from the African side. We'll have African heads of state. We'll have ministers from across the continent who are responsible for trade or health or ICT. And we'll get top people and officials from the administration who are at, you know, the U.S. Export-Import Bank, Millennium Challenge Corporation, State Department, Commerce Department, Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, the U.S. Development Finance Corporation, USTDA. So every year we'll have people like that, but you never know quite who will be the head of the U.S. delegation. I got a message this morning that we had one more head of government coming. The Prime Minister of Mauritius has joined, I believe it's six other African heads of state.
So you have seven of them so far who have confirmed coming?
Yes.
What do you think will be the major takeaways for them during the summit?
So first of all, it's more than just the takeaways. It's the engagement. Because where is there an opportunity for African heads of state and top officials from the U.S. to meet with CEOs of both U.S. and African companies, C-suite executives who are doing business in Africa or who would like to do business in Africa? When would you have the opportunity to talk to people about major issues like energy transition and critical minerals and agribusiness and ICT and digital developments on the continent? And so one could say one of the main takeaways is the dialogue. Just the fact that you'll have a session that will have, you know, we have high level dialogues in different areas. And so, you know, we have one in ICT. You know, the president of Botswana will be in that one, along with the head of U.S. Trade and Development Agency. They're one of the three agencies that's responsible for the Digital Trade with Africa initiative that was launched during the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit in December 2022. I believe there will also be takeaways. There'll be MOUs that will be signed. There'll be business deals that will be launched or finalized.
I was about to ask you if, for those who have participated in previous ones, what the feedback has been and what you think the anticipated feedback will be for these people. Does it translate into investment into their various countries, you know, especially for youth unemployment issues that they deal with at home?
What we love is that we're able to provide those access and connections between these key people. So from the last couple of summits we've had in 2022, we were in Marrakesh, Morocco. And just as an example of something that happened since then, in Marrakesh, Morocco, the president of Botswana was there, as well as CCA's current chairman of the board, John Olajide. This is the first time CCA has had a diaspora African chairing its board of directors. And John is a Dallas businessman. He has a health tech company there, but he's also in agribusiness and in tourism as well. And so when he and President Masisi met in 2022, they hit it off. And President Masisi said, well, come to Botswana and let's see what you want to invest in Botswana. And so, in fact, that's what John Olajide has done now. In late 2023, you know, it takes a while for these things to come together. But in late 2023, he invested in a tech company there. A tech business there and invested in that. So these are the things that we hear about that are happening. But we also have investments that are sort of on the move. When I met with President Lourenco of Angola in February at the AU summit in Ethiopia, one of the things we talked about was how enthused he is about an investment in solar energy in Angola by one of CCA's member companies, Sun Africa. And Sun Africa has a $900 million backing of the U.S. Export-Import Bank. So there's going to be a signing event in Dallas between Angola and Sun Africa with the head of the U.S. Export-Import Bank there. We're very excited about that.
Florizel Lizier is president and CEO of the Corporate Council on Africa. She spoke with me from Dallas, Texas. Join us on Sunday for the conclusion of the conversation. A leading governance expert and human rights activist says plans by former Malawian president Arthur Peter Mutharika to run in next year's elections appears not to be generating popular support. Onduli Mwakasungula says the former president should examine his motive for seeking the presidency. If confirmed by the main opposition Democratic Progressive Party or DPP, the former president, analysts say, will challenge incumbent President Lazarus Chakwera. Mwakasungula's remarks come after parliamentarian Kondwani Nakumwa, who was expelled from the DPP, announced the formation of his own party, the People's Development Party. Nakumwa had been the leader of the DPP in parliament until his expulsion following a disagreement with former President Mutharika. Onduli Mwakasungula tells me that it appears the former president has yet to come to terms with his electoral defeat to President Chakwera.
Peter Mutharika's intention of coming back in 2025 to me is an indication that he's out of touch with the Malawi current political dynamics, and it raises so many questions of his motivation or motives, I should say, to come back. But also, first, he must understand and accept that he is a former president, and I believe this is something he does not believe and accept until now, hence all these sentiments that I want to come back and contest as a president in 2025. But I think Mutharika's intention also of coming back must be critically be examined in terms of its implication to his own party, where many young cadres are interested to stand but not given space, but also from the big and broader picture, the implication of our democracy, where we allow former president to return in a country of over 20 million plus people.
Talking about implications, the last time I spoke with him, he talked about the fact that the party is more united after some officials or representatives of the party were let go or expelled, and that Malawians have been calling on him to come back because he argued that the current administration has not been able to meet the aspirations of the people or kept their promises, for which reason they were voted into power.
I don't agree with those position from him, because if people are leaving the party, DPP has shown that it's not democratic. What I'm saying is that young minds, young cadres would want to take over the leadership. So because he's interested to contest, he has managed to force those young progressive minds to leave the party. We heard yesterday the former member of the party, who was the leader of opposition, Kondwana Nkrumah, launching his own party. And this one was a very strong leader in the DPP. But at the same time also, we cannot say that Peter is the solution for this country. I think the country, to me, the challenge of Malawi is not about leadership. It's all about the system and structures which we have to deal with. So Peter is not... He cannot say himself that he's the right person. He's the only person who can help this country to come back to where Malawi was. I don't believe in that, and I don't agree to that.
But Onduli, several religious leaders called on him to run or to contest, and then you also have some party chairmen across Malawi who have endorsed him ahead of the coming Congress as their presidential candidate for the DPP. And they think that he stands the best chance of defeating incumbent President Lazarus Chakwera, who won the last election, which basically makes this a repeat of the last general election between former President Mutharika and Dr. Lazarus Chakwera.
Yeah, because, you know, you have to understand that Malawi has groupings which are partisan. They will take position, they will take political lines. So if there are religious groupings who are endorsing for Peter, you know, they might have their own interest. And you know, the voting pattern for Malawi is more on ethnic, you know, based. So those type of calls will come. But at the same time, as I say, DPP is a party. So there might be a party loyalist who will come and say, we're endorsing Peter. But to me, I find if people are going to endorse Peter, let it be more democratic and transparent. But you cannot let others who are showing interest to stand, you are stopping them and they end up leaving the party. And these are the potential candidates for taking DPP forward. So to me, you know, as I said, I'm not very much excited with the coming back of Peter Mutharika. And I would, if I was an advisor, I would have said, don't come back. Give space to the young mind, the progressive mind, to come in and support them to challenge President Lazarus Chakwera if he's standing next year. But also it's important that Peter must understand, the former president must understand that, you know, there's life after presidency. And Malawi is not a personal family project, you know. There's so many things you can do after being president. But we cannot allow in our democracy that we have a former president who wants to come back as if maybe there are no other Malawians who are able, who are potential and capable of taking over the presidency in this country.
Andule Mwakasungula is a leading governance expert and human rights activist. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. The Secretary General of Nigeria's Trade Union Congress, or TUC, says the pay increase for public sector workers announced by the government undermines ongoing minimum wage negotiations between the administration and labor unions. Nuhu Toru, however, says the pay increase should only be considered as an award but not part of the demands by public sector workers in the talks for a minimum wage increase. His remarks come after the government announced a 25% to 35% pay increase for civil servants to help cushion the effects of the high cost of living. Representatives from labor unions in Nigeria are demanding $443 monthly minimum wage in negotiations with the government. For more reaction to the announced pay increase for public sector workers, I reach Nuhu Toro.
The pronouncement makes nonsense of the entire process of minimum wage negotiation. The government do not even have the competence to lord a figure through our throat, except if they are making an award. And if they are making an award, of course, the president has the authority to say, okay, I've given the workers X or Y amount. But to be under an illusion of the assumption that that is minimum wage negotiation is not correct. Minimum wage negotiation has to pass through a tripartite procedure, bringing employers, employee, and members of the private sector. It's not really possible for the government to just announce a figure and be under an illusion that it's minimum wage. The president can give an award, can grant an award to the Nigerian workers, but what was announced today is not a minimum wage. It's just maybe an award from Mr. President, because you will agree with me that the minimum wage negotiating committee has not consummated negotiations. And in negotiations, it's give and take. You bring what you can pay to the table, the workers argue what they think the workers need to be paid, and at the end you have a unanimous consensus of what ideally should be paid to the Nigerian workers.
The question a lot of people are asking is, if the government has raised salaries for civil servants by between 25% and 35% to help them cope with the rising cost of living, that should, many say, should be a positive development rather than attract condemnation from the trade union groups like yours.
Well, I don't think your assertion is also correct, because if you pull men of integrity together in the name of a minimum wage negotiating committee and they are talking, negotiations are ongoing, and suddenly you make a pronouncement which jettisons all of the work that has been put in to check the Nigerian constitution and the way the minimum wage emerges. It's a product of negotiations. It's not something that you just pick on the table and announce at will. So the entire process negates the essence of minimum wage negotiations. That is what I'm saying.
So with this negation that you spoke about, will the negotiations still go on with labor unions such as the Trade Union Congress about another or possible increase in the minimum wage?
Well, as far as we are concerned, the minimum wage negotiation has not been consummated. We suggest that we are still going back to the negotiating table to push the position of the Trade Union Congress of Nigeria and the workers under TUC.
What are your expectations of these negotiations, especially with what you talked about, consummation?
We don't have any fixation. We have made our demands. We've put our demands before the table, and in putting our demands before the table, we did our due diligence. We look at the high cost of living vis-a-vis the value of the minimum wage that is currently being paid, that is already eroded. And we arrive at a conclusion on what we think will be reasonable to put 3 square meals on the table of a worker, himself, his wife, and 4 children. We'll also be able to articulate what we think will be sufficient to take the worker to his workplace and back home. Don't forget, the government promised they were going to provide CNG buses to do that. Those buses are not available yet. We have also articulated what we think is reasonable to be able to take care of the medical expenses of the worker and his family. We have also looked at what we think should be sufficient to pay the school fees of the children of the worker. So all of these indicators put together was what we put as our demand. And again, the NLC also did put forth their demand. So at the end of the day, negotiations are ongoing. And like I said, negotiations are not cast in iron. It's give and take. It's a win-win situation. That point of win-win, we have not gotten to. And until we get there, I mean, we are not going to be under an illusion that a bill or perhaps an act is set in place. So we are very hopeful. We'll see, go back to negotiations. We will ensure that we push further the position of the TUC and Nigerian workers and hope to get result at the end of the day so that we can have a negotiated minimum wage for the hardworking and resilient Nigerian workers.
Nuhu Toro is Secretary General of Nigeria's Trade Union Congress, or TUC. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, a parliamentarian from Uganda's ruling National Resistance Movement, or NRM, has rejected calls by the opposition for Western nations to impose sanctions on President Museveni, his son, and other top leaders of the administration. David Kabanda says calls for more sanctions are misplaced and appear to be a move to seek sympathy and financial support for the opposition. His remarks come after Robert Kyagulanyi, also known as Bobby Wine, called for sanctions on senior government officials, including the president, for allegedly participating in human rights abuses and corruption. Supporters of the government reject the accusations. Parliamentarian Kabanda tells me that the opposition leader must stop maligning and tarnishing the reputation of the president and his government.
First of all, I want to encourage my brother, Honorable Kyagulanyi Ssentamu, the leader of the opposition in Uganda, if he wants at all to take power in Uganda, to concentrate on mobilizing Ugandans to support him, not to malign President Museveni, not to malign Ugandans before other countries, because that will not help him, and those people will not make him president of Uganda. We very much know, and we are aware, that he has been getting support from the Western part of the world to host President Museveni, but he can use such resources to come and convince not to malign Ugandans, because President Museveni, General Muhoozi, have not done anything to him except to defeat him in an election.
But the NUP leader accused President Museveni and his top leadership in participating in egregious human rights abuses and corruption.
Honorable Kyagulanyi Ssentamu knows it very well that he is the leader of the opposition in Uganda, and he appoints the leader of opposition in parliament. The leader of opposition in parliament is not appointed alone. He is appointed alongside with the chairperson Public Accounts Committee, COSACE, and other accountability committees in parliament. I want him to ask those people he appointed in parliament to head those accountability committees, to ask those corrupt people to appear before them, and they are exposed. If they are found guilty, they should either refund what they have stolen from Ugandans or be arrested, because he has the powers as the leader of opposition to expose the corrupt.
His call comes after the Speaker of Parliament and other officials from the NRA were sanctioned by the UK over similar issues of corruption and human rights abuses.
The Speaker of Parliament is not involved in any corruption scandal in Uganda, unless the UK government wants to say that these sanctions have been put on the Speaker for chairing a sitting that passed the anti-homosexuality bill, which was assented to by His Excellency the President. Because when they say that the Speaker of Parliament was involved in corruption scandals, like taking the iron sheets that were belonging to the Karamoja people, many people, including the Vice President, the Prime Minister, and other ministers, were involved in this scandal. How come they are handpicking, they have picked only the right honorable speaker among all these people, and they leave others out? Yet there are even those who are before court, whose cases are before court.
The Anti-Homosexuality Act that you talked about was moved by Asuma Basalirwa. He is not sanctioned yet, so Robert Kyagulanyi feels that it's not explainable, because it really defeats the purpose of the accusation that you are leveling against Robert Kyagulanyi and the sanctions.
If you have been following political events in Uganda, Robert Kyagulanyi Ssentamu was in Bujiri at Honorable Basalirwa's constituency, and he was complaining about Honorable Basalirwa to have betrayed the cause. Which cause has he betrayed? Fighting the homosexuals in Uganda? And he stated before that this law was brought by President Museveni, which means he thinks Basalirwa was used by President Museveni and the Speaker of Parliament, who vehemently came out and said, we are not going to accept the homosexuals to take over Uganda. So whoever says that sanctions have not been put on Basalirwa but on other people is just trying to mislead Ugandans that Kyagulanyi is not supporting the homosexuals. That's where he gets all the money he uses in his political activism, and therefore he's using these Western powers to put sanctions on Ugandans. I have told you, if True is fighting corruption, he appoints chairpersons on all accountability committees. Which case has he asked his chairpersons to handle and they have not handled?
David Kabanda is a parliamentarian from Uganda's ruling National Resistance Movement, or NRM. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. A recent trend is taking hold among herders in Kenya and elsewhere in East Africa. Instead of driving cows or cattle, they are turning to camels because they are naturally better equipped to handle the harsh weather conditions that are getting worse due to climate change. VOA's Rick Pantaleo spoke with Dr. Rebecca Carter, the Director of Climate Adaptation and Resilience with the Global U.S. Climate Program World Resource Institute.
Rebecca, herders in Kenya have gone from cows, cattle, to camels in recent times. Why?
So experience is showing that camels are increasingly better suited to the environment of East Africa. As it becomes hotter and more arid, camels are proving to require less water and different types of forage that are more resilient to climate change. And herders are just finding that they are a less risky investment because they are more able to withstand severe drought, high temperatures, things like that.
What are the camels used for?
They are quite multi-purpose, I would say. Milk, meat, also for transportation. There's a whole range of different types of uses that they have. And another important aspect of this is that, you know, when a family is able to invest in a camel or two, they also have the potential to raise additional camels, which can also help improve their household finances.
Where are the herders getting camels from?
That I am not entirely sure of, but I would say that as usual with capitalism, when there is demand, supply increases. And so I would not be surprised if, you know, there are groups of people who have been in the business of raising camels for a while who see an opportunity. And you could think of this as sort of a private sector investment in adaptation, in that I would expect that some of these more traditional groups that have more traditionally raised camels are seeing an opportunity to expand their sales of them into new areas.
And finally, this switch from cattle to camel herding is an example of something called transformative adaptation. Can you tell us about that?
This is something that I and my colleagues at the World Resources Institute did research on over several years. And it's a concept that is actually put forth by the IPCC that adaptation is going to require both sort of incremental changes, where we gradually sort of make our existing systems more resilient, but also in some cases where climate impacts are quite severe and where they're becoming apparent quickly, to actually overhaul entire systems. And so the example here is that these are areas where cattle were predominant for many decades, but as the conditions change, the system of raising cattle, grazing them, marketing them, is gradually, well, actually fairly quickly shifting over to camels instead, because they do make more sense for the new environment. And we can look at this with other types of agricultural changes as well, like, for example, attuning crops to be better fit for the environments in which they're raised. We've tracked examples in India, for example, of farmers who are shifting from corn, which can be quite drought intolerant, over to millet, which offers a lot more resilience in terms of when there's a drought, those farmers are more likely to get a harvest of millet than they are corn. So yeah, it is a type of change that I think we're going to need to see more and more of all around the world.
Dr. Rebecca Carter is the Director of Climate Adaptation and Resilience with the Global U.S. Climate Program World Resources Institute. She spoke with Rick Pantaleo from Washington, D.C. And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
We met a beautiful girl, no bada bada. Mkwano ya guleka, she no wano bada bada. Oh, musabi ya gyori nakalema. Yesu viso mkwano, muna natele gulema. Mkwano kwa ika nakalema nakulima.
Tugende muhulide mkutuwale kata Uno mkwano lujoru kutule pata Eti selabu yonze seka nakata Ndikuwa kalaba ya enebacha Bali njogera kukatimbo muyeye ya wasa mkwano saba Kaima kasune kukita Mkuka kasanti sinza chita Back when in the river but me never go see no fish Some say a pleaser, some of them a say a punish Remember say me tell you so you better than they have a telephone Yo loco loco that a chicken in a Spanish Same bill
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Impuga and engineer Bill Andrade, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a fly will not get into a closed mouth. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.